Hello, I'm Dick Clark. Welcome to another edition of Rock Heroes. Now, this week we take a timely look at a man who is quite literally one of the unsung heroes of American rock and roll, Bruno Radalini, a man whose influence on music and musicians is legendary in the world of entertainment. He even played a vital role in the formation of the Beatles.
Yeah, he introduced me to George one night at the Cavern Club, and that's how it all started.
I'm Jim Yukich, and this is my 80s-ography.
Welcome to 80sography in the second part of the Jim Yukich interview. It's a bit of a long one, but there's loads to get through and lots to enjoy here. Beach Boys, Michael Jackson, Bruce Willis, as well as the Phil Collins Genesis, as per episode one. A couple of things to note, it's four audio commentaries in this episode, so feel free to sync up and enjoy those. And also possibly my proudest moment during this podcast at the end of 1988, so listen out for that. Otherwise, please enjoy part two of my interview with director Jim Yukich.
Part two of the interview commences now.
Thank you so much for sending that stuff through. That's amazing.
Yeah,
Absolutely amazing.
I thought you'd like it. You could see what I was talking about with that Take Me Home thing. I had that sheet almost fell apart because it was...
So you had that in your pocket for 7 months, basically.
Yeah, basically, yes.
Did you ever almost lose it, like take it to the dry cleaners and think, oh shit, this is my trousers, let me get it back?
No, because it was always, you know, I always actually would take it out, you know, at the end of the day and put it in the luggage, you know, in my shoulder bag base, you know, so I keep it like that. But it was, I mean, if you touch it, it's almost like cloth now, the paper, because it's so beat up.
That's amazing. So was any of this actually written down before you did it? Or was it always, you did a place and you filled it in, you did a place and then filled it in?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was, you know, I would think in advance, like, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to do this one. It would basically keep a track of where the last one was so I can remember in my head, okay, this is there, and then this is going to be there, and this is there.
What I love about Phil Collins' little note at the top is that
he has
to write his own album credits. I recognize the handwriting. That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah, it is. So, yeah, the Spitting Image people did the storyboards for us.
So was it like based on your notes, or was it like you discussed together what the video would be and then they go away and draw it? How would that actually work?
We had a meeting, John Lloyd and I and John Blair, and we talked, you know, kind of like through the whole song. You know, we put together a lyric sheet and we kind of just made notes at the meeting that day and then went away and the storyboard showed up. I mean, literally the meeting was probably 3 weeks or so, or maybe 4 weeks before we shot the video, because we had, they had to set everything up on their end. They were still working on the puppets for Tony and Mike, right. And actually Phil as well, because Phil's puppet didn't work. The first one didn't work. They thought it might work, but the expressions were wrong, they felt, you know, and so, yeah. So they were working on that. And then the storyboard showed up at my door here in Los Angeles. I actually still have them in storage, and they're on huge poster board sheets. They're amazing. You know, like I said, each one is as big as a real poster, and there's like probably 12 or 18 frames on each one, so that they'd almost be artwork. I mean, if it was like a Genesis Museum or something, you could put like
definitely.
You could put them, you could frame them and put them all in a row because they're on black poster board. So they're really, really done well. I have a lot of things. In fact, I brought them out with me, and they're in I still have a Boots bag here, Boots Pharmacy, that has in the bag, it has the toys from the Mama album.
Oh, cool. Really? Okay.
Yeah. The ones that they used, they did the album obviously, and used that, that did the album cover. And when I did the Mama tour, I wanted to use the album cover to animate those toys to start the beginning. And so I spoke to their office, and they sent me the ones that they used for the album cover.
Wow.
And they never asked for them back. So I've had them for like 35 years or something like that. It's pretty amazing. I'll send you at some point. I took a photo of the album cover with my toys kind of coming out in front of it. So it looks like they're falling off the album cover,
but it's brilliant. Exact. Yeah, if you could, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah it's a lot of fun. I thought at some point somebody might be interested in it. Although I don't think there is now. By now, it's like kind of gone, you know.
No, I disagree. I think people would be fascinated by that. I mean, they even thought about the actual kind of little bricks from the Genesis cover would actually still be around somewhere.
Yeah.
But the fact you own them, that's really cool.
The kind of things are kind of fun to have. And then, you know, like all the storyboards, pretty much I've got faxes because we used to fax before email. I've got files of faxes from Phil. With notes about this or that, or what he, you know, either about what he might like me to do on the edit, and or what he wanted, you know, what the next song was going to be, and that kind of thing. All in his handwriting, you know. Yeah. So it's kind of neat.
So generally, would you do your own storyboards for the videos?
Yeah, because I mean, the ones that were difficult, not difficult for me to do, because I used to draw most of them myself anyway. But the ones that were difficult to do were done by, you know, somebody else. But when I mean difficult, I don't mean like artwork difficult. I mean the fact that there's going to be a lot of them and they have to be pretty detailed. And so songs like No Son of Mine, I have the storyboards for that, and they're professionally done, and they were really nice. Other than that, like the Billy Don't Lose That Number one thing that I sent you, that's all me doing that.
Does it cut out a lot of time and money doing that?
You know, if you're filming, it lets the assistant director and everybody else know what the setups are going to be. So I did the storyboards for, let's say, We Can't Dance, okay? Or I Can't Dance, sorry. I did all the storyboards for it, and then I send them to like the AD, which is the assistant director, and he put them on poster boards, and then we would put them and number them as to what the setups were. So we knew we had this and this and this, and we would know what we still had to do. And so on the stage, on the wall, there'd be all these storyboards so that people knew what still has to be done.
Right.
So it's good for the lighting people and everything else because they know, okay, we got this set up next, or on, you know, over on that set, we have to light that set and get these shots next. So it kind of gives everybody a jump on how much thing has to be covered in one day.
But I take it you still have the flexibility to just go what's happening on the day as well, if you think
better. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And the ones that were storyboarded were like things like I Can't Dance, because we had the commercial, you know, the parodies in there.
Yeah.
And and the stuff we shot with them in the, you know, like on the soundstage. And then we didn't storyboard like Invisible Touch and those kind of things, because that's just like have fun day.
1986.
Invisible Touch was an interesting shoot, because the challenge with that one was two things. First of all, my partner, Paul Flattery, who produced most of the stuff over the years with Phil and Genesis with me, was getting married that weekend. And so he wasn't able to go to England. So I had to go with another American producer from here who worked with us for a long time, who was actually more of a production manager, but he went in Paul's place. And it just so happened that that weekend, we were also doing a video for a band called, and it was Emerson, Lake and Powell, which was Keith Emerson, Greg Lake and Cozy Powell on drums. And the song was called Touch and Go. So that was kind of our Invisible Touch and Go weekend, because we shot on Saturday. On Saturday.
I can hear a mashup in my head. I can sense a mashup. She seems to have an invisible touch. And grabs right hold of your heart. She's
She seems to have an invisible touch. Yeah.
Yeah. And on Saturday, we shot Invisible Touch, and on Sunday, we shot Touch and Go. Touch and Go was more like then Isle of Dogs down in that area, and Invisible Touch was in a grain warehouse somewhere, and I don't know what part of town it was in. The other interesting thing about that weekend was it was the weekend that Chernobyl exploded. And so we're shooting this video that's supposed to be this high, you know, happy kind of video for Genesis, knowing that the wind might be blowing radiation towards England. And so we were kind of panicked. And when we finished Touch and Go that night late, I had the producer get us flights. The first thing in the morning, we were like the first flights out of Heathrow on that Monday morning just to get out of there because we didn't want to get all radiated. We didn't know, nobody really knew what was going on with radiation at that point. The challenge with Invisible Touch marketing wise was, you know, it came off of Phil's album, and there was, you know, Hit and Run really wanted to let everybody know that the band was still together, that they were still friends, they were still together, and that there'd be more to come. And so we put them in the situation where they're just having fun, and they were running around. And if you notice, Phil's got like one of his funny coats on he wanted to get, you know, in that video at times. And I gave them Super 8 cameras, so they shot some stuff themselves of each other. And it was just kind of like, okay, we have three or four cameras. We got Super 8 cameras. Let's just go in there and shoot a bunch of stuff. And it was really hodgepodge, you know, and got to the point where Phil was playing guitar and Tony was playing drums, and, you know, and it was a real fun day. And it also was only maybe 4 hours worth of time for them, which they loved. I mean, they hated hanging around for long videos. So to get in and out that quick made everybody happy anyway.
Yeah, that's amazing. So all their bits, I mean, the whole video is all of them, isn't it? It's not there's anything else in the video. It's not them. But the fact that was all done in 4 hours.
And it's also kind of funny, if you think about it, that they spend all this money to do it, which back then, like I said, there was no, you know, there was no video or HD or 4K. So you're shooting on film, 35 millimeter film, which is very expensive. And then you've got development of the film and transfer of the film, telecine, they called it. So it's, you know, it's a big chunk, a big cost, a couple $100,000 to shoot this thing. Because of the size of the crew and all the set, you know, that we brought all the stuff in to give them something to do. And they want to get out of there in like 2 or 3 hours. I mean, the cost part of it didn't mean anything to them, which is fine. It is kind of ironic that they just say, okay, let's get done like in 15 minutes. They'd be happier. So that was the whole idea behind Invisible Touch. And then then we did In Too Deep as well, I think, that year. And is this 90s stuff I'm talking about or 80s stuff?
No, we're in 86. I know some of it kind of spills into 87, but
okay, good.
The process, because 85 was very much Phil Collins' year, 86 is very much Genesis' year. So I'm going to cover all the Genesis videos this period under 86. Yeah. So over what period of time did you make all these videos for Genesis then? And at the beginning, I mean, do you know exactly how many you're going to be making?
Most of the time, Tony Smith would hint that there'd be like, you know, these two, and then there'll be another two later or something. I mean, generally, it was like three or four that we knew were going to be up front, were going to be videos. The obvious ones, Invisible Touch and In Too Deep, and then Anything She Does, which was kind of a weird choice for a single. And that had Benny Hill in it. I don't know if you remember that one.
Good evening, gentlemen. Fred Scottle Esquire, your new head of security. Are there any special instructions?
Yes, you see, we fired the last guy because too many people were getting backstage.
And people we didn't invite, too.
Yeah, by the time they come off the stage, all the food's gone.
Have no fear. Scottle is here. Security will not be laxative while I'm here, so I promise you that. I've been at this job for 30 years, you know. I've handled them all. I have. The Osmonds, I've handled them. The Ink Spots, I've handled them. Herman's Hermits, I've handled them. Dolly Parton, had the pleasure of working with her once. Yes.
Did he know who Genesis were?
And he knew their music, yes. But it was interesting because, you know, we were talking about the idea, and the idea was that they were backstage, and, you know, we have this wacky janitor who comes in and screws everything up and at the last minute fixes it. And I think Phil or somebody said, boy, it'd be great to get Benny Hill. And we thought, well, yeah, it'd be really great to get Benny Hill to do it. So we called Benny Hill, and Benny Hill said, oh, yeah, I'm a huge fan. I love their music. I like Phil's stuff. And my fee is £100,000.
I love and, Genesis and Dr.
Yeah, Pearl. Yeah. And it might have been 50,000 pounds. I can't remember the exact number, but it was really high for back then. We called them and they didn't even blink an eye. They said, get him. So he came and he was a pleasure to work with. He was so much fun. He brought all his gags. He brought the aerosol can with the spray to make, you know, steam come out of his ears and all those things. And he knew, you know, his stuff, and he knew how to shoot his stuff from his show. So he kind of helped guide us along and said, we need to do this, we need to do that, put the camera here and we'll do this. And so it was a lot of fun. And we did a lot of like sped up motion things, because that's, you know, very typical of what he would do on his show.
Yeah. Were you aware of the concept of the Page Three Girl? Because that's kind of what the song is about. You know, the Page Three Girls in the video. Did you know about that?
Cause
you spent a lot of time in England, hadn't you?
Yeah. It was, I couldn't remember if it was Page Two or Page Three, but Page Three. Well, I knew, because at the studio at the farm, which is their studio, Fisher Lane Farm, they had in the control room Page Three Girls taped on the walls all the time. So like someone would bring it in and tape it on the wall, so there'd be like at least like five or six Page Three Girls. And it was kind of interesting. The studio was great during the time. I think, I don't know if Hugh was there for some of the stuff. Most of the stuff when I was there with, maybe with Hugh Pageant for some of the things that we did there. We just usually meet there and talk about things or listen to something and decide if this is good, what we want to use for video. Nick Davis was, I think, the engineer who was always there too, and Jeff Collingham. The interesting thing would be they would have, you know, either tapes on the wall, strips of tapes that back then on a mixing board, you'd put, you know, every time you did something different, you'd put like a piece of the white tape down at the bottom of the fader. So you knew this was the guitar, this is the drums, the hi-hat, the keyboards, Tony's keyboards. And so all these strips would be there for all the songs they were working on, because if they switch and go to another song, they'd pull off the one tape, stick it on the wall, and then put the other tape down on the mixing board. So you would see these names, and I'd always try to figure out, okay, which song is this? Because like Monkey Zulu, okay, there was a song called Monkey Zulu, and Monkey Zulu ended up being Tonight Tonight.
Yes.
Tonight. You know, and then something on Phil's album, the long way to go was like something like Bombs Over Something. And then I Wish It Was Rain was called Lionel Richie. You know, so they didn't have the title. They didn't have the titles yet. Those were like the working titles for all the songs. I have a cassette tape somewhere from No Jacket Required that has all the working titles instead of, so Studio was on there, but the rest of them are pretty much just.
That's a working title that stuck, wasn't it? Because he couldn't think of anything else to replace it with. So just
right.
Keep the working title. Yeah.
Yeah. For Studio. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are kind of fun things to have. I've got tons, lots of, besides the film that never came out, lots of behind the scenes things. Like when we did Throwing It All Away, which is probably out in the 90s, we shot, you know, that whole Detroit Toronto end of the tour backstage, and ended up being the video. The reason that became the video is because we had shot all that stuff, and we got that stuff. Sony gave us all these little handy cams that just had come out like that. They weren't even out in the market yet, and Sony sent us about four or five of them. We gave some to the band and we shot stuff, and we just shot all that stuff, and I took all the tapes and put stuff together from that, and it became the video for Throwing It All Away.
Yeah, so that would have come out in 87.
Yeah, so it was fun getting these things and collecting these things and going back to your original thing. Yeah, we knew how many songs, except there would be like curveballs. Like the curveball was Billy Don't Lose That Number, because we didn't know that would be a single at all. I think that they didn't know either. I think it was going to be Take Me Home to Studio One More Night. And then because those were so successful, the record company wanted another one.
Okay, so it was led by the record company, basically.
Yeah, I think that somebody said, you know, we could probably get another single out there. And, you know, the choices were, I mean, like Inside Out, I think, was a choice. And, you know, and like I said, Long Way to Go was a great song, but it wasn't really a single.
Mm.
It may have been with a good video, because it's a beautiful song, you know, so it could have been with a video. The record company would say, here's what we think. And the more videos that, you know, we could do would be great, because the more singles they can get out of the album. Later in the years, like this, But Serious album that Phil did, I think we did every song somewhere, you know, there's a video album came out of that I think maybe three songs were actually songs we shot live on the road, but the rest were actual videos that we shot for the album.
Right. So would the record company give you a budget for the Invisible Touch album video project, or would it be a budget per video as you were making them? So when I ask, like, what was the range in time of making them, is like, were they all done in a relatively short space of time, or was it like you do one every couple of months, and when the record company say, like, we need a new video for the next single?
Usually the first one or two were done in advance of the release of the album almost. And then the next ones were done somewhere on the road or something, you know, somewhere you'd fit them in. Like Tonight, we shot the stuff in Los Angeles. Is that in the 80s?
It's all 87.
It's all blur for me. But Tonight, we shot the stuff that looks like Blade Runner here in LA at the Bradbury Building where they shot Blade Runner. And there's a Phil lookalike doing like the walking around, the silhouette kind of walking around, going up the elevator, leaning over the balcony. So we shot all that stuff here. We shot the stuff that was like that video, Tonight, was kind of a combination of a couple movies. Sometimes I would do, not so much with Genesis, but with a lot of other videos, I would do what's called a steel-o-matic. And you would take movies off of Laserdiscs or off of VHSs or something, you bump them onto my 3/4-inch editing tapes, and I would edit them to the song that we're doing. So you could kind of see what the feel was like and what it would look like if you had this kind of footage with this kind of music. So Tonight was Blade Runner. There was a movie by Scorsese called After Hours, which I don't know if you ever saw, which was really, which was great. And that's kind of the part where the kid's getting his head shaved off, because there's a scene in that movie where he doesn't have any money and he's trying to get his taxi to get back to his apartment. And he goes into this club and it's this weird thing with chain linked fences and people shaving their heads and getting tattoos. So that was that movie.
What do you want from me? I'm just a word processor, damn it!
And I think I'm trying to think if there was the third one was. So anyhow, all the movie stuff was shot out here in LA without the band, and they were on tour at the time. And the stuff with them singing, with the kind of chain link fence and the blue light, the HMIs, was all done in Kansas City, in a studio in Kansas City, which is really an odd place to shoot because there's nothing there. I mean, in terms of sound stages, you know, we probably had the only TV studio or warehouse big enough to shoot this thing in. And there's no support system in terms of 35 millimeter footage, you know, like film or cameras and stuff. Everything had to be brought in, and there's no sound people that are local, you know, camera people that are local. I mean, there are, but they weren't like of the caliber back then that we would hire them to do the stuff that we needed. We'd always bring in a cinematographer and the key people, but in that case, we had to bring in almost everybody to do it there. And again, Phil has one of his funny coats on, if you'll look at that. And the other interesting thing about that video was it was done in February of 87, I believe, or January of 87, sometime like that. And my first son was due that week, you know, in LA. So, you know, the band had arranged for a private plane for me if I had to leave at any point to go back to LA, which was very nice of them, but we didn't have to use it.
That's very considerate.
Yeah. So it's I forgot that album was in the same year as well, in the 80s. After the 80s, they went into this, I think, But Seriously was the 90s, right?
But Seriously came out in 89, so there's some crossover. So
it's crossover.
I want to do the audio commentary for I Wish It Would Rain Down, because the single came out early 1990, so I assume you would have filmed it in 89. So that just makes...
And ironically, it was called Lionel Richie, and Lionel was at the set that day.
Why?
I don't know, because they were friends. I guess Phil thought the song sounded like a Lionel Richie song. So that's why
Can you have got Lionel in the video then? Just have like a walk-on part or something?
Well, I don't think we thought, you know, I mean,
give
it
him
would
a mock
nice, but we had no idea. We had no idea he was going to be there. And he was just, all of a sudden, he was there. And we already had Eric was in it, you know, and Lamont Dozier is in it. I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, is he? Whereabouts is he?
He's playing piano. He's the guy playing piano.
Oh, is he? Oh my god! I didn't know that. Okay.
So yeah, Lamont's playing piano, and he's the one obviously who was with Dozier, Holland. Yeah, Dozier did all the Motown songs.
Legend.
And then he wrote Two Hearts with Phil.
Of course, yes. You know, so he would have written that by then, wouldn't he? Because that was 88, as he before.
Yeah, right. So we had Lamont, and you had Eric and Chester on drums. And Leland Sklar on bass, an upright bass. So, and then Jeffrey Tambor, who's the main actor in that, is actually, you know, he wasn't like very famous back then.
This is a couple of years before Hank Kingsley. I was going to mention that when we did the commentary, because you were ahead of the game there, weren't you?
Hey now.
Yeah, but he he was one of our, we had a couple guys that we always used in videos that were like professional actors, because somehow we got friendly with them and they liked doing the videos with us. And they also liked, you know, back then, the more stuff that they did, the more film they got on them, they could show people what they're, you know, what their ranges and what they're doing.
Showreel.
So Jeffrey was in quite a few of our videos. He probably was in like 4 or 5 of our videos. And then he went on to do like, you know, whatever it is, modern.
Yeah, he was in Larry Sanders' show first.
And then, Larry Sanders, yeah. And then
Transparent.
Oh, yeah, he was huge for that.
Yeah.
And obviously, he won like Golden Globes and things for that. And then there's another guy that we used to use a lot in videos, but actually, he was in a Mike and a Mechanics video. I'm trying to think of what it was.
I saw All You Need Is a Miracle. It's got Victor Spinetti and Roy Kinnear.
Oh, well, that was
the two guys that Americans would know from Help, the Beatles film.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Oh, it won't work. I don't expect it to work. Could work if the government would spend some more money. Made in America, you see.
You're another failure, aren't you, scientist?
The idea, as I see it, is that we expand the molecules and the ring grows bigger and it drops off.
What's your electricity bill like?
A sort of long counterfoil.
And that's why you hired them together.
That's because I'm a huge Beatle fan. Phil is a huge Beatle fan. Mike is a huge Beatle fan. I mean, originally we thought, you know, that Spinetti would be good as like the not the evil guy, but the owner of the club who would be. And then we thought, well, if we can get Roy Kinnear, and it was the first time they acted together since Help. So
it was 20 years. Yeah.
Look at the crowd. Place is practically empty.
Well, you can't blame us for that. We were called in at the last minute. We're very big in Guildford.
It was kind of neat to do that, and that one was a lot of fun. Again, I'd love if that looked better. I watched, in fact, after we had our chat, I was watching on YouTube some of the other videos, but not on my computer, on my TV, and they look so bad.
They look quite grainy. They need to be I mean, they've started to do like 4K restorations of pop videos. You do see them. I saw one for Last Christmas, Wham, that looked amazing. You need artists to start, or record companies to start like taking them seriously, because it makes such a difference when they look like they should look.
But we would do things where they were at. So if they were in Kansas City, we'd have to shoot in Kansas. You'd have to shoot, work around their schedule as much as you could, and see like what days they had days off. Whenever the third or fourth video came up for an album, that you'd have to try to scamper, you know, everything together and get into that town and shoot it and get out and then bring on. And that was also risky back then, because I always worried, and luckily, I don't think we only had a problem once. It wasn't on any Genesis video. You'd always worry that when you're taking film and audio and things through like the X-ray and back to, you know, to LA, that something would get ruined on the way back, you know? So in the later days, when we switched to, you know, the video and to 4K and HD, now when you do that, you always make a backup, either on a drive, or back before they had drives, you'd make copies of the tapes and send one separate than the other, so nothing would get lost. But back then, when you shot something and it was on film, you know, you would never know if something was going to go wrong. And we've had things, very rarely things would get messed up. The one time something got messed up really bad, and we didn't know, because you couldn't tell until we got back to LA, was for a band called GTR, which is Steve Hackett and Steve Howe's band.
I was going to ask about that, yes.
And that we shot in the studio with them at Townhouse Studios with them, and Jeff Downs is the producer. And we did a whole documentary for like a month of them. Until we came back, we didn't realize that the Nagra that we were using back there, which was rented in England, the crystal was off, so everything was out of sync. And it was drifting, so it was a fix, but it was a massive fix. So we got an insurance claim, and we went back. And to show you how simple these things could be done, I mean, there was a good learning experience for us, because you're in the studio for a month with the band, and you're shooting as they're progressing this song and that song, and this song and a bit of that and a bit of this, hit an interview here and an interview there. And you go back and there's a problem, and you realize, okay, let's go back and reshoot some of this stuff. And we actually shot what we needed in 2 days, because we knew after a month, we knew what we needed in terms of interviews, in terms of, okay, let's get them in the studio and let them do When the Heart you know, the beginning of this part, or just the drums doing it only, you know, so we just shot the bits we needed in 2 days as opposed to a whole month. So that was like a lesson to us that in the ones we did in the future, we would just go in, observe for like a day or so, and then bring the crew in and just basically fake the recording of the Elf. And that was one of, is GTR's 80s or 90s? That was 80s, wasn't it?
That's the same year, 86, because that's what was interesting, was in that year you did Genesis, Mike and the Mechanics, and GTR, all Genesis related.
The other thing that was interesting about GTR is that it was supposed to be just guitars playing, you know, synthesizers, but Jeff Downs basically programmed a lot of synthesizers on that album. So it wasn't just guitar. You know, it was supposed to be the first album with no guitar, and the guitars are using synthesizers to play. Well, most of it was kind of like that, but there's a lot of Jeff Downs on that album.
A couple more questions about Genesis before we move on to 87. The In Too Deep video, it seems there's a couple of shots that seem like they're aping Phil Collins' album covers. There's a shot of him where it's a close-up of his face that looks like face value. There's a shot from the side that looks like it's Hello, I Must Be Going. Was that conscious?
Not conscious at all. Because he's like an icon. So, it's like you shoot his face and it looks like his album covers, right? So, that was a very difficult song to do a video for, because they called us and said, okay, we're going to do a video for In Too Deep. We want to do it in London, okay? And they could only be here for 3 hours. They're doing a tax year. They're in France, and they'll come over, do the video, and leave. And they have to be done by 6 o'clock. And so they came over in the afternoon, like at 2, and we shot for 3 hours, and that was it. That's why it's very stark, because there wasn't much we could do in that song except just do a little performance, have a little art direction. We had a couple glass shots that didn't work out. I don't know if you know what glass shots are. We used to shoot through a piece of glass that was painted. There's a guy named Eric Kretschley who was phenomenal at that, doing that. And he actually ended up falling off his roof and dying, I think, in an accident a couple months later. But he did glass shots for a lot of Russell Mulcahy's videos. He came over and did Betty Davis Eyes. He did there's a glass shot in that. He did Gypsy for Fleetwood Mac. You know, he's got this, great background with the trees and things. But he did a couple shots. And what that involves is you put the glass down in the beginning. You say, here's a shot, here's a set. He would put a piece of glass down and he put a camera there, and he would work looking through the lens of the camera and then on the glass and actually paint. And you do this elaborate thing to make it look like it was this huge staircase that went up where Phil and the guys were up on. And it just looked, it ended up being like like if we shot them from the 2 miles away from the pyramid that they were sitting on. You know, it was just too ridiculous compared to everything else. So that came out. But it was a tough video because they also were dressed in 80s kind of slick outfits, and they normally didn't do that. You know, they were normally never slick like that, and so they got a lot of criticism from the label and the marketing people saying, "Oh, that video made them they looked a little bit too slick, like Duran Duranish kind of thing, or something."
Okay,
And they ended up using those outfits. There's some promo pictures that they took with those outfits, and they look good for promo pics, but they felt like for the video, it was kind of a mistake for them to dress like that. Tony Smith was getting bombed by the label. And the reason was because it wasn't a hit. It wasn't really a hit song. And it really didn't do as well as the record company had, they really pushed for this song to do it. And it wasn't a hit. So then they had to put the blame on somebody. So they put the blame on Tony and the video and us and the way the video turned out. That's why Tony was kind of mad, and he didn't want to spend a lot of money on the next video. So that's a lot of reason why throwing it all away became the down and dirty, let's shoot this with just video cameras.
It
basically cost, like maybe 20 grand compared to, everything else, because everything was done, on the tape. So that was kind of like the compromise that we gave the label, another video for like basically nothing. But the interesting thing that Tony Smith did, which most managers started to do, higher level managers, but a lot of them didn't want to do, was that he would front the money for the videos. He would pay for the videos. So Hit and Run would pay for the video. Let's say it was a 200,000 hour video. He would pay the 200,000. Then he would go to Virgin over there and say, I'm doing a video for this song, because they wanted a video for that song. He goes, okay, I'll do it for half. I'll pay for half, you pay for half. They would give him 100,000 hours, okay, out of that. But he retained ownership. He said, give me $100,000 and I'll retain ownership and I'll pay the other $100,000. They would say, fine. Then he'd come to America and go to Atlantic Records and say, you give me $100,000 and I retain ownership. And they give him $100,000 and he retained it. So basically he got the video for free and he owned it.
That's genius.
Yeah. I don't know why they didn't catch on, or maybe they knew, but he did that for all these videos. So Genesis basically own all their videos.
So how much would you monitor the success of a record once you've made the video? Because you're talking about the fact that In Too Deep wasn't a massive hit. It was a number three in America. It was only number 19 in the UK, but it was all the singles from Invisible Touch were all top five. And Invisible Touch was number one. So would you actually monitor to see how well the song and the video effectively is done? Or would it be like, I'm over that. What's the next thing I'm working on?
No, we would always, because you'd always see it like on MTV or something. So you'd always kind of wonder. And we get the trades and you look at the charts and see where the song was. And you always hoped it would go number one, because the more number ones you had, the easier it was to get work for us, because right. People think, oh, you know, we were the number one guys. But it was sad when you do a song that didn't, although, you know, In Too Deep seems like it's got lasting value, and not the video, but the song. I mean, I still hear it a lot now. As like almost like a Genesis classic.
But it was a massive hit at the time. It was number three in America. That's a massive hit.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that you see it as something that was underperformed, or
the record company felt that it was not what it could have been, which is kind of odd.
That is odd. And number three wasn't enough.
Yeah. Because it's like, they always feel like, okay, that means the next one's not going to beat that. So they're going down in the wrong direction.
Right. And also Land of Confusion won you a Grammy for best concept music video.
Yes.
Was that a surprise, or were you thinking like, got a good shot here?
I thought it had a shot, because it was so, you know, it was so much work to do, and it was different. Ironically, that was the time of Sledgehammer, and it was up for 9 MTV awards, I think, and it didn't win any, because Sledgehammer won them all.
Yeah,
you know, and so
damn you, Peter.
So it was kind of a shame, but I kind of felt that it was more to the liking of the Grammy voters than Sledgehammer, because I mean, Sledgehammer, Peter wasn't as big at that point here as Genesis was, and it had the Reagan and the political thing going. Yeah. So I thought, you know, I thought he had a good shot. I didn't go to the ceremony because it was in New York. And I was up for a couple others over the years and never won. The only one I actually won for before that was Modern Love with David Bowie, you know, as best video of the year or whatever it was. The categories kind of changed over the years. But I was very surprised. I was in L.A. and watching it on TV that night, I thought, you know, and it wasn't, I don't know if it was an award, it was on TV or not, but it was in New York. And two friends of mine who were also up for a Grammy were there, called me earlier that evening, because 3 hours ahead in New York, and said, you won. You know, I was like, are you kidding? This is like fantastic. I figured if anything, it's going to, you know, not only boost my career, it's, you know, to win a Grammy, you have to grow up like, you know, like you and I as music fans. And then to win a Grammy, it was like, oh my gosh, this is great.
Where'd you keep them?
I have one in a box in my closet.
In a box? You have it in the box in your closet?
Yeah.
If I had a Grammy, I'd wear it around my neck everywhere.
Yeah, I had them out at our other house, but we just moved we're in the desert now, and there's really no shelves yet or any place to put them. I had a really nice cabinet at my other house that I, in the dining room, that it was in on a shelf, on a glass shelf, and people would come in and most people, it was funny, because most people wouldn't notice it, or if they did notice it, they'd say, what is that? Is that a Grammy?
You know? Oh yeah, it's a little Grammy, got shoved away.
Yeah, it's a Grammy. It's a Grammy, it's kind of neat.
I think you should convert half of your house to like a Phil Collins Genesis Museum. You've got the Genesis bricks. You've got all those notes. You've got all the storyboards. You've got the Grammy. I'll pay my $10 entrance fee.
Yeah, a lot of audio stuff. A lot of like signs.
Yeah, it'd be amazing.
Posters and pictures. When we do a documentary, when you do like something behind the scenes with them, we did a number of shows over the years, like making the album or to promote the new albums, basically. And we would do interviews, and I knew we did so many of them that I knew the answers to all of the questions, you know? And so it would be kind of like, oh my gosh, we got to ask this because people want to know this, obviously, but I know what Mike's going to say. But what was cool about when you'd edit them together, I had done a number of them, and it's always hard when you always want to have music underneath. So you have a, like a live song going or maybe a performance thing, and it trails off and you hear a voice talking in an interview, and then you cut eventually to the screen and you see the person talking, and then it might go back to that song. Well, when you do that with a song, when there's lyrics in a song, there's always this kind of conflict, you know, where you can't understand too much what the guy's saying in the interview because you've got like Phil screaming, right, you know, tonight, tonight, tonight underneath it, you know. So I have lots of DAT tapes that they gave me of these albums that I worked on that are the instrumental versions only.
Instrumental versions, oh. Well, if they managed to accidentally sneak onto YouTube, then, yeah. You know. Which so are really, weird, Jim. Just like,
which are really cool, because if you listen to song like, cool, yeah, if you listen to a song that's got incredible stuff going on in the background when the vocals aren't there, you really appreciate what Tony's doing and Mike, what they're doing, because it's so good. And you can't hear it on, you could hear it, but you can't really hear it on the regular ones.
Oh yeah, I'd love to hear those. That would be cool.
Now time for the audio commentary for Land of Confusion by Genesis. 3, 2, 1, play.
Okay, so I got the clock here at hand. Glass just came down. Yeah, that's so in this set right here, you've probably got 12 people hiding. Okay, you've got each one of these puppets has three people operating it. One does the eyes, one does the eyes and squints and things, and the left arm, the other one does the right arm and the head, and then there's another one who does any other movements by the puppets on the stage, like if their legs or anything else move. And so it was the hardest part of this whole video, doing this video, was to hide people, because they're real life size puppets. So we did this down in Isle of Dog, I think it was Limehouse Studios or something like that, or where they were based on, Spin Image was based on. It was an unheated warehouse. It was like about, like, you know, it was freezing. We had heaters going full time. It was 7 days to shoot it, and we had storyboarded the whole thing. I could send you copies of some of the storyboard things if you want to see what they look like. But the Land of Confusion, I met with John Lloyd, who's the guy who was their director there, and John Blair, who was a producer there. And we actually storyboarded the whole idea for so every shot, there's no ad-libbing in this whatsoever. If there's ad-libbing, it's just the, like, which puppets are in this group shot, basically. But the difficulty was, like, now that's a real person with a Reagan mask on, actually, because we needed the legs. But every one of the shots where there's a puppet, you've got to hide so many people. So you would actually bring people in and you'd put the puppets where you wanted them. And then you would, after you did that, you would light it for that scene. So everybody would walk away except the DP. And that was Peter Sinclair. And he would light it for the shot. And then you would bring the people in and you'd say, okay, we bring art directors in because we got to hide now 12 people. And you'd bring in chairs and things because everything was raised up a little bit. You could hide them underground underneath, and they had all their monitors flipped so that they could see things, what it would look like from the opposite direction when they moved their arms and stuff. It was really complicated, but fun. Puppeteers were all great people. I actually shot behind the scenes on this whole video and gave it to Genesis then on their box set. I think one of the boxes, the one that I did the writing for, the box, the middle years, 83 through 94, whatever it is. They had me send them all my footage that I shot on video 8 of behind the scenes, showing how guys holding the puppets and everything, which was really fun. And I loved doing this. I mean, this was like amazing because it was storyboarded so well, and we didn't shoot it in order, but I had the song, I had an editing system set up in the warehouse. I had the song set up on a tape, and we had what's called a video tap, which I don't know if your listeners would know, but it's a way that I could see what the camera's shooting. It was a black and white image only because they didn't have color video tap back then, but it was basically what you're seeing, but it was through the lens kind of. So you didn't have to wait for the film to be processed. So I would record the video tap. And after each setup, because it would take so long to do the next setup, I would actually be recording and editing
the show, the song. So, right. So when we shot the last scene, the video was done. Basically, right. So all I had to do then was go to the online facility and have them assemble it, you know, from the film. So okay. It was fun. Now,
is it true that you see Phil Collins in one of the crowd scenes? Is that just not true? Is it a fact that I've seen on IMDb about it, that Phil Collins himself appears in one of the crowd scenes at the end? I take it as true.
In this?
Yeah.
In the video? No, he's not in it.
No.
That's the one thing that they loved about doing this video.
Whose hands were they? There's the baby.
There's a little baby hands. Those yeah. The one of the producers' son just had a baby. Their wife had a baby. She brought it down.
All right.
For that. And then there's a shot somewhere in here of the Pope playing bass guitar, slap bass guitar. And I don't know if we took it out or we moved it. We cut it down because Tony, there it is. But it was a lot longer, and Tony Smith was worried about it because he thought all the Catholics would get upset that the Pope was playing good bass guitar. But it was, it was the kind of, you know, the kind of experience that like a once in a lifetime experience to do it, because it was so difficult but yet so rewarding to do. And it was a favorite video that they have ever done because they weren't in it.
They weren't in it, exactly.
Yeah, they loved the fact that they weren't in it.
Yeah, such a brilliant video. I can't tell you how many hundreds, maybe thousands of times I've watched that video.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing in the 80s, certainly in the UK, there wasn't really many places to watch videos. So I remember buying the Visible Touch video that had all the promos on it and that like 20-minute live preview thing. There's very few places you get Top of the Pops, but they show like 2 minutes of it. And
Morning television only shows like 30 seconds.
Yes, or you get like a video at 5 to 8, they'd show one pop video every day. Yeah. That would be it in the UK. So like to see something like that all the way through is very rare. So when you saw it, I'd buy the videos and watch them over and over again, because that's the only time you get to see pop videos, you know, all the way through. On IMDb for Land of Confusion, it's one of the best facts I've ever seen on IMDb, was the Mike Rutherford puppet was used again in Spitting Image.
As Jesus.
As Jesus, yes.
Yeah.
You see that?
Yeah, I saw it. Well, you know, those puppets cost 10,000 hours to make. 10,000 pounds. Sorry, not hours, pounds.
Right.
Each one. And they had Phil from Hello, I Might Be Going. That's where I actually got, you know, saw the idea. I was in the hotel, the Carlton Tower, and Spitting Image was on, and the Phil, Oh, I Must Be Going was on. And I thought, oh, my God.
This song is a great song. It really captured.
Yeah, this is great. And I said, they have a puppet. So I told Flattery, I said, they have a Phil puppet. All we need is two more puppets and we could do Genesis, or we could just do a Phil video. You know, we talked to them and they were into it, and Genesis was into it. And it's funny because I actually came up with the idea for the cover, the Atlantic Confusion CD, which is the three puppet heads. Mm-hmm. I said, you should do like a Meet the Beatles with the puppets. Yes. And they did that. And then it's like on the back, it's like art designed by some guy who does their albums or something. And I thought, oh, that's bloody.
Didn't get the credit.
So who cares? I mean, you know, at least I know I did it. But anyhow, they had to redo a Phil puppet anyway, because the one they had for Hello, I Must Be Going was, he was crying and he was kind of like, so they updated him. And it took a couple weeks to make the puppets.
And that's why there's two in the video.
Are you feeling good? And now let's stop a moment for an ad break.
Hi, this is David Lizerbram, the co-host of Rock Docs, a podcast about movies about music. Every week we discuss a different music documentary. All eras, all genres are considered. Fans of 80s music, for example, may enjoy our recent episode about Tina Turner, and we've got a lot more for you over at Rock Docs. So wherever you get your podcasts, please check out Rock Docs. Thanks.
Now back to the chat with Jim and Daddy. Enjoy. 1987.
So 87, before we get to Bruce Willis, a video I came across in my research was Jungle Boy by John Eddy.
Oh, yeah.
I'd never heard of John Eddy. And if you watch the video, it's like a cross between George Michael, Elvis, and Bruce Springsteen. And it's a brilliantly edited video. It's one I find quite mesmerizing. I watched it a few times now.
He was managed by Champion Entertainment, which is a company that was run by Tommy Mottola. I don't know if you know who Tommy Mottola is.
Yes.
Tommy, he became head of Sony Records and things. But they also managed Hall & Oates and John Cougar Mellencamp and lots of other people. And so he was like their new
star. He was the next Springsteen to them. He was the next John Cougar to them, or John Mellencamp. He was the next guy. And he ended up not being the next guy, unfortunately. But they wanted to do something that showed his kind of like street grit, his kind of like, you know, almost like a James Dean kind of look that he had. So what I did was I came up with this idea, and basically it was an idea that I, you know, I would sometimes sit around with people and we'd talk, and I'd say, or somebody would say to me, if you were Gatoli and Cream, give us one of their ideas. So that John Eddie is basically an idea that I came up with, that I was pretending to be Gatoli and Cream, because they would do simple things and expand them into like Every Breath You Take. You know, they just did the black and white thing. The one that they did with Every Breath You Take, the one with the candles.
Wrapped around your finger.
Yeah, wrapped around your finger.
Yeah.
They did it, basically shot it, you know, instead of, they shot it at 48 and played the audio at 48 and then played it back at real speed, so everything's slow motion. So it's like one gag. You know, we say it's okay. They're kind of like one gag people. They'd have all these gags. And the gag for John Eddie was that we would get cameras in 360 around him, completely around him and above him and below him. And to get from one cut to the next, you had to go through the cameras in between. So we couldn't afford that many cameras. So we got this huge, the grip made this huge ring, probably like, I mean, a diameter about like 35 foot pipe that had, I think, 8 cameras mounted on it, or 10 cameras mounted on it, almost like a clock. And you put the ring at eye level around him, and you load all the cameras, and he would sing. And then you would tip the ring 45 degrees one way, and he'd do it again. Go back the other way to level, and then 45 degrees the other way. Then you go front to back 45 degrees, and essentially you had a sphere that had, you know, eventually you'd have all these cameras around him, and he would be like in the center of this. And I took American Basketball and marked it with, okay, here's all the cameras positions. This is take one, camera three, four, with marker on this basketball. And I had an editor back then edit it. And I said, okay, you're going to edit this song, but if you want to go to this camera from this camera, you got to pick a pathway using these other cameras to get there. And so that's what it was. And it's funny that you brought it up, because it was one of these things that nobody ever noticed. Nobody ever thought, oh, that's interesting. Something's going on here. But it's
very
unique. It's very unique because
it really sells the song as well.
Yeah, to get to one spot to the other, you had to go through these spots. So that's what gives it this kind of interesting editing sense.
Yeah, it's really effective. So yeah, so good work. Okay, so 87, you worked with Bruce Willis. So there's a video for the Respect Yourself single, and then there's a Return of Bruno mockumentary.
And there's also a song called Save the Last Dance. We did that video as well.
That may have been a bit later. I think that was the next album we did, I think.
Okay.
So which came first?
The project came first. Bruce was from New Jersey. Bruce was a bartender, and he worked in a club in New Jersey. Robert Kraft, who's a audio producer, he works for 20th Century Fox. He does a lot of movie stuff. He did a TV show here called Glee. He works on all that stuff. But his wife, Beth, was the assistant, like my boss's assistant. She was his secretary, basically. And Robert used to play in the club in New Jersey. He was a musician before he was an audio producer. And he played in this club, and he met Bruce, the bartender, in this club. So when Bruce decided to be an actor, Bruce came out and slept on their floor in the Hollywood Hills in their house. So Bruce, you know, was sleeping on their floor. He got the job in a show called Moonlighting, a TV show.
Yes.
And it took off, and everybody's talking about Moonlighting.
Hi, I'm Madeline Hayes, and this is David Addison.
Right. And we'd just like to take a minute or two before the show starts to welcome you back to another season of Moonlighting.
That's right. That's wrong.
Wait a second.
I don't know why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing here.
You're here because we're welcoming people back to another season.
Ha.
You're here because the network wants us to welcome the viewers
Double
back.
Ha.
You're here because Lou told you
to do it. We can say it. The network says tonight's show is too short. The network says every show has to be 1 hour long, not 59 minutes, not 61 minutes, 60 minutes long, and we're a minute short.
Great, now the whole world knows, Mr. Thermopolis,
and do you know
Mr.
why
Ehrlich,
we're a minute short?
Karen, get my agent on the phone, please. Not
you
because
slow
I'm
down
talking
once
this,
in a while. Maybe we could have a show that lasts an hour. That's it, I've
That's
had it.
That's it. If the producers want to welcome the viewers back,
they can do it themselves.
And, you know, someone suggested, you know, we should do something with Bruce. He got offered an HBO special, and Robert told him about me and Paul Flattery, you know, our company, and said, you should talk to them and do, you know, let them do your special. And so Bruce said, oh, you know, came over and we talked, and I always kind of wanted to do one of these parody things where it was like a fake career, and it would, you know, we would shoot all these period pieces using people and things, you know, that I grew up watching, you know, bits and pieces of shows and things that influenced me over the years. And so we thought, okay, well, so Bruce agreed, thought it was a great idea. Let's do it. So we were shooting at that time in Too Deep, and I talked to Phil, and Phil's wife, Jill, at the time was a fan of moonlighting. And I was telling Phil about it and saying how we're, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to do a phony career. We're going to do interviews. We're going to make it seem like he had this huge thing. He influenced these people. And Phil said, well, let me say something. You know, so we said, you sure? And he said, yeah. So during one of the breaks, he sat down and we got him and we interviewed him talking about Bruno and kind of making it up. But we didn't even have it written at the spot, but we knew kind of, you know, okay, let's say Bruno influenced the Beatles. Let's say he influenced this and that. So we kind of gave Phil like a ballpark of what to say. And he just said a couple of things. Say, Bruno, he was like fantastic.
He was a real hero of mine. Fantastic bloke. It wasn't so much Bruno's singing that impressed me. It was more the amount of acid he took before he sang. I think he took more acid probably than anyone's ever taken in the whole world in one go, you know, and it really impressed me.
And Mike Rutherford actually did a bit too as well for us. And so took those two things back. Showed him to Bruce. Bruce loved them. Said, oh, great. We got Phil Collins. He was like, you know, because Bruce wasn't Bruce back then. He was like Bruce Willis from the, you know, the bartender.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he was probably way bigger than that. But I didn't know it because I never had watched Moonlighting at the time. I kind of, after we met and everything, I watched a couple episodes and I thought, oh, he's good. He's interesting. But I didn't realize he was like a heartthrob and he was like huge here in America. I didn't realize he was a heartthrob until he used to come to our house to do the edit. And my wife's friends would always conveniently stop by, you know, they say, oh, you know, oh, I didn't know you. Oh, yeah.
Always a sign, isn't it?
Yeah. Cause I had an edit room in the house and Bruce was there, you know, editing with me when we got the stuff in, but that was later. But going back to, we got the Phil Collins video and him doing the interview about Bruce. So we sent a letter to who we knew, Ringo's manager at the time, and said, we're doing this project with Bruce Willis. Luckily, Barbara, his wife, had watched Moonlighting, knew Bruce Willis was, and Ringo thought, oh, it's kind of funny, and they got Phil Collins to do it, so I should do it. Maybe it's a hip thing to do. So we got Ringo, was at the Beverly Hills Hotel. We went, shot him like in about half an hour. We shot him saying stuff about, you know, he was bigger than the Beatles, blah, 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 blah.
Well, if it hadn't have been for Bruno, there would have been no Beatles.
And then we got Ringo and Phil in a can. My partner, Paul Flattery, with Russell had done videos like, you know, I'm Still Standing and a lot of Elton John videos. So he called John Reed, who was Elton's manager. Elton was going to be at the Universal Amphitheater in LA. And John said, yeah, Elton would love to do it. You got Phil and Ringo. It must be cool. We'll do it.
Bruno gave me an invaluable piece of advice. He said, nothing succeeds in life like excess. So I always remembered that. And I think it's worked for me.
So once we got the three of them, we could get anybody we wanted. Because
did you do all the interviews yourself?
Yeah. So we told everybody, you know, that we got Ringo, Elton, and Phil. And next thing you know, we got people coming out of the woodworks, you know, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and Grace Slick. And, you know, and you name it. And they all wanted, everybody wanted to be in it. The Beach Boys wanted to be it. Brian Wilson wanted to be in it.
Brian Wilson was there. What was he like?
That was the first time I ever worked with Brian. And he was out there. I mean, in a sense that he, you know, his attention span was very short. And
that would have been right in the middle of the Dr. Landy experience, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you'd have to tell him a little bit about, and so you kind of coach him as best as you can what to do, you know, and you say, okay, Brian, because all those shows that we put these people in, like I used to watch American Bandstand, and I used to watch, and all these shows we would do, I mean, we used all those, and Brian, we thought would be great because he was in that era with American Bandstand. So we'll say, well, he was on the show with Bruno and the Heaters or the Bad Boys. And let's have him talk about that. So we kind of talk to him and coach him through it, but he would only get like
I mean, it was really hard to get him to get two sentences because it was a weird period for him. He was, everybody said he's getting back to normal, but he was still really, you know, very nice, but difficult to get to repeat things. He'd forget what to say all the time. So, yeah, so Brian did that.
There was a battle as to who would go on first, and Bruno was scheduled to go on first, and he wasn't too happy about that. A fight broke out and kind of messed things up, and Dick Clark, of course, canceled all the rest of the tapings and stormed out mad, and we were pretty mad too, you know?
I have a funny Brian Wilson story. I don't want to take you too far off of this, but I had worked with him then afterwards a couple of times. We did a video for a song called Somewhere Near Japan.
Yes, I was going to cover that in 89. Yeah.
Is that in the 80s?
Oh, yes, 89, so I was going to ask you about that. Yeah, you go ahead.
Yes, okay. So we did a video for Brian, or for the Beach Boys. Brian was in L.A. The Beach Boys were on tour in Florida. The record company Capo said, we want to make people think that Brian's in the band still. So could you shoot Brian in L.A. and shoot them on the road in Florida and figure out a way to make it look like they're together? So we got this backdrop that we figured, okay, we got this backdrop, we'll put it behind Brian, and then we'll put it behind them when we get there, and we'll leave a spot to kind of put Brian in, you know, in the group shot if we do any group shots down there. And so Brian shows up at the stage. We got one dolly track going back and forth, and we got a stool for Brian in front of the backdrop. Got this whole crew, because it was like a real short shoot because we only needed him to do, you know, like the song a couple times. And we were also at the same time on the same stage shooting inserts for two other videos, the Doobie Brothers and somebody else. So because we had so many things going on, we had a studio and we booked, like, we were doing three different videos in that studio that day. And so Brian shows up and he sits on a stool. I had a guy make cue cards with the lyrics because I knew how Brian was. And I said, if we don't have cue cards, he's never going to know what to sing. And so we made cue cards. I talked to Brian and said, okay, Brian, the dolly's going to go back and forth. The guy's going to have the cards underneath the camera. All you have to do is jump in on your parts, because I know it's hard for me to tell when Carl's singing and when you're not singing because your voices are similar. Just jump in on the bits that you did. And he said, fine, fine. I said, you want to hear it first? Go through it? He goes, no, you guys are doing other stuff. Let's just get through it. Let's go. And I thought, okay, good. So he's doing pretty well. And we put the music on, start the filming. Dolly's going back and forth with the lyrics. Brian's looking at it, and he's staring the whole time. First verse goes by, he doesn't sing a word. Second verse goes by, doesn't sing a word. Now by the third verse, he's got this kind of scrunched up nose face where he's like, and his head is tipped each time the camera's going back and forth. Like he's just like looking at these words, and you know, he's got this scowl on his face. A whole song goes by and he doesn't sing one word. Okay. So the song ends, it's dead quiet in the stage because there's like, you know, there's like 30, 40 people on stage between lighting people and everybody, and everybody's silent. Nobody knows what to think. It's like this weird, weird thing. And I walked up to Brian in the stool and I said, Brian, you didn't sing on this song. Everything okay? And he goes, I didn't sing on this song. I don't even like this fucking song.
He wasn't on the actual track itself.
He wasn't even on the intro track. The record company never told us, and he didn't tell us when he sat down.
So he didn't know the song, you know? Basically. So he couldn't.
He didn't know. Well, I think he probably didn't know what song we were going to do, or what. I mean, I don't know. It was, but it was like one of these really funny things, you know, that was only rivaled by the first time I met Brian before that, which, I mean, the second time after the Bruno thing, when I met him backstage and we were talking at a Phil Collins concert. And it was another one of those conversations where you think Brian is okay, and then all of a sudden falls off the table, you know, and it's funny. But in over the years, he's gradually gotten way better. It was funny because at that period, everybody was saying, oh, Brian's back. Brian's doing well. Brian's doing well. But he really, really wasn't, you know, I mean, for years, he wasn't there. Yeah. And I just did a video a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, and Mike Love was in it. And we had all these great Brian discussions. And it was very interesting. And if you're a Beach Boy fan, it was fantastic talking to Mike, because he was filling me in on all this Brian stuff in the background and the Landy things and stuff that I didn't really even know that were amazing.
Anything in particular?
Well, no, I mean, like just the whole Manson thing, Charles Manson, and how he would come home at night, and Manson was mad because Mike, you know, had told Manson to move out of Dennis's house, and Manson would have his people write in blood, you're dead, or you're, you know, kill Love, and all, you know, in blood on his house, on the walls, you know. And then Mike would talk about Brian, saying how Brian's wife was, you know, like manipulating him and his, I mean, his current wife, you know, that she was basically the brains behind the operation. And she just kind of like kept him locked in a room, you know, theoretically. And it's interesting to hear Mike's perspective because it's completely different than, you know, like when I've talked to Carl Wilson and all these other people, their perspectives were all these 100 degrees, 180 degrees apart. So it's funny talking to them because you get these wide different opinions. And then you got your Al Jardines, who out of all of them, I didn't really, you know, I don't know. He might be a nice guy, but he just, that day that I worked with him, he just seemed like a pain in the ass, you know, that everybody else is really friendly and fun. And Bruce Johnson was there and he was like one of the fun guys. Carl was great. Brian is great. And Mike is great. But Al is just like this kind of like mean old man kind of, you know, weird.
That's kind of the reputation that Mike Love has, because you hear a lot of people say he's like one of the most like disagreeable people, and he's always got these
funny
negative opinions of others. And
oh yeah, yeah, but he's a really funny, nice guy. Right, I liked him a lot. I thought he was, I mean, when we went to do the video for Somewhere Near Japan, went to Florida. That was the first time I ever met Mike back then. And I was on the side of the stage. We just got our laminates so that we could watch it. And they were playing with the band Chicago. So he came off stage between like when Chicago was playing and I was there and he goes, oh, are you Jim directing the video? And I said, yeah. And he introduced himself and like, I didn't know who he was. And I said, he goes, oh, did you get your passes and everything? You're all set. And I showed him the laminate. And I said, yeah, I think, is this okay? We're okay with this. And he grabbed it. He goes, wait. And he flipped it around. He goes, shit, this is a good laminate. You're singing fun, fun, fun tonight. So, you know, so, I mean, he was always joking around and a lot of fun, I thought. Right.
Okay.
And then then you hear these stories, you know, but so, yeah, so we shot that video with them there and then combined it with the Brian stuff back in LA when we did the edit. And it wasn't a big hit, but it was one of these things where they had just come off of Kokomo and everybody thought, oh, these guys are on a roll. Mm-hmm. Let's do this. And it wasn't, again, a great song. The song was written by, I think, everybody but Brian, you know, Mike and I think John Phillips, I think, was one of the writers. Scott McKenzie, who wrote that Wear Flowers in Your Hair to San Francisco song. And I think John Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas as well.
Yeah, it's not really a Beach Boys song unless Brian Wilson's around.
No. So it was funny because Brian hated the song.
And he wasn't on it. All right, back to Return of Bruno.
Yeah.
So Bruce Willis has a writing credit. So would you actually be in a room writing it together, or was it because he just like give his ideas and you go away?
No, I had all these ideas for like different bits. There's a lot that we didn't do. I wanted to do the Brian Wilson in the sandbox thing with Bruno. You know, playing the piano in the middle of a living room with sand, and we didn't do that. So I had a lot of other just weird things. And again, they're all just parodies of things, you know, like the Beatles doing All You Need Is Love in a studio is No One's Home, a song called No One's Home that we did.
Yeah.
And No One's Home wasn't on Bruce's album. That was actually Robert Kraft and Bruce in the studio record. They recorded that separately just for the project.
Bruno showed us this film, No One's Home. You know, I think that started the whole psychedelic era.
Our journey's just begun. Quickly, take your place. My eternal travels of myth and space. Dead wanderers we all through the sea of sullen bliss. There, behold the gates of nothingness.
They made that up because I told them I wanted to do a psychedelic thing. And, you know, I said, let's do like some kind of psychedelic thing. And I can't remember if I said No One's Home or something, but they did the song. It was great. And a lot of the other bits are actually songs from the album. The interesting thing about the beginning, the early years is starting with Dick Clark. Do you know who Dick Clark is over there? Yeah. I don't know. Okay. Yeah. Well, Dick Clark here doesn't lie to people. I mean, people look at Dick Clark and he's an icon. He was for years. He had American Bandstand and a bunch of shows. He produced a bunch of award shows. Everybody knows Dick Clark and he's like America's sweetheart. Okay. I don't know what your equivalent is there, but no one would ever even think that he would be fooling people or lying. So when we got him to do the hosting of the fake show, it was incredible because nobody thought it was fake.
Hello, I'm Dick Clark. Welcome to another edition of Rock Heroes. Now, this week we take a timely look at a man who is quite literally one of the unsung heroes of American rock and roll.
I mean, to the point that we still have it. We were flying back from France. We were in France, and Paul was given this magazine article in a French magazine that talked about Bruce Willis's career before he was an actor and show all the Bruno stuff. You know, it was like implying that nobody knew this, but look at what Bruce did before he was an actor. And so it faked a lot of people out. And with Dick doing it, it faked people out. The first part we shot, it was supposed to be like the Cavern Club. I thought, okay, the Beatles and the Get in the Cavern Club, the black and white thing, him singing. I can't remember what the song was, but he's got a leather jacket on and a little hat. And we were going to shoot that, and that's at the Whiskey a Go Go. And we set up, got everything ready to go. We're going to shoot, we got original old 60 millimeter film and stuff that we could scratch up and make it look like it was old and shoot it in black and white. We had a cameraman who specialized kind of in that look, recreating that kind of look. And so we set all this stuff up. And that afternoon, we get a call from Bruce. And he said, I'm not going to be there tonight. We said, why? He goes, well, I'm still in Hawaii. He was in Hawaii with his girlfriend, who was Geraldo Rivera, this news reporter's ex-wife that he was dating before Demi Moore. And he said, we're going to stay in Hawaii a couple of days. Is that okay? So Paul Flattery said, well, you're going to lose about $60,000 a day until you get back here and we shoot it. So it could, you know, if you're coming back in 2 days, it's going to cost you probably like $120,000, maybe $130,000. And Bruce said, yeah, that's fine. Go ahead. Keep it and I'll pay that. And when he posted, if you cancel it, it might be like $180,000. And Bruce goes, that's fine. If it happens, I'll just pay that. So we got the set. We got all these extras, got like 30, 40 extras, got all the equipment there, the lighting, the band equipment, and we had nothing to shoot. And so Bruce's hair and makeup woman, who traveled with him for moonlighting and all this stuff, came up to me and said, you know, Bruce has got a younger brother, David, that looks just like him. So in that section, that's Bruce's brother David.
I couldn't tell.
It worked great because he's supposed to be younger at that time anyway.
Right,
it's like
right.
It's like his early period. We put the hat on him to make sure he looked. You couldn't tell it was Bruce, but
sunglasses as well. Brother. Yeah,
yeah, that's Bruce's brother David singing that part,
amazing.
Or doing that whole scene. Yeah, so we kind of like, you know, all those things, and then the photo session we did with the band, those were all shot by Henry Dilts, who's a friend of ours, who shot like the covers for Crosby, Stills and Nash albums and Eagles albums and different things over the years, Joni Mitchell, and so he shot like all this stuff. Like he was actually the official Woodstock photographer as well, so he shot all the promo stuff. The Woodstock scene we shot in the area in LA called the Sepulveda Dam Basin, where it's just this bare ground area where we set up a stage to look like Woodstock. And again, we shot it in the same style of Woodstock and bought some of the Woodstock footage to edit in with it. So it was, it was a blast to do. That was one of the most fun projects that we ever did, because we were doing all these things, you know, just bizarre little shoots all the time and interviews and things. And to be able to interview some of the people that we did, like Bill Graham, who was a major promoter in America.
We were lucky. The guy was fucking great.
And Wolfman Jack, who was this major DJ. And
I was on the air that night, and he kind of, during the show, he kind of like grabbed the microphone. He said, you're listening to the Wolfman Jack show. And he goes, ow, like this. And well, the name just kind of stuck after that.
You know, we had all these people. It was fun. And then, you know, HBO and Bruce wanted to go into his modern concert. And we said, well, why don't we just do it as two shows? Why don't you do it as the Dick Clark thing and then do it as a concert and do it. And they said, no, HBO wants it to be one continuous show. They didn't want like it to seem like one ended and the other started. And that always bothered me, because Michael J. Fox puts the tape in and it goes to the live concert.
I got some tapes here. I'm gonna tape over some of these. Yeah, Cosby. Anyway, you watch.
Oh, now we're gonna have some fun. Watch out.
And then it comes back at the end to Bruce and the Dick Clark thing. And it's, so what I did was, I have a version that I did that doesn't have the Bruce at the Hollywood Palace live stuff. It's just the return of Bruno, basically.
So did you have to edit anything out to accommodate the live footage at the end, or was it always going to be that length?
No, we didn't. There's nothing really. We used everything. Yeah. Pretty much everything we shot, we used. The shorter version that I did without the live stuff is way better because it's like a funny comedy show.
Yeah, it just seemed like the live stuff did seem, watching it again, like tacked on, like, why is this here?
Yeah.
You think it's going to be like one song, then go back to the documentary, and it's a disconnect. It's like something completely different.
Yeah, they didn't care. They just wanted something to slide people into the live show, and then it's weird because you think you're just going to get, like you say, just a little bit of a live thing, and you end up watching like 30 minutes of it.
It's like, oh, yeah, there's another song. Oh, there's another song. Oh, there's another song. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
When was the last time you watched it all the way through?
I don't think I've watched it all the way through for years, like maybe 15 years. I've watched bits and pieces, you know, because I've taken snippets in there out, you know, but I haven't watched it. But when I did watch it again, what struck me was how bad it looked. It's just such a shame, you know, that I wish they could make it look better. But
the version I found was really kind of grainy and kind of, yeah, like it was almost like a video copy or something, or copy off VHS.
Yeah. 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 I have a laser disc of it somewhere, which is probably the best quality. It's still, 5:25 or 4:25.
Yeah. I haven't watched it in over 30 years. And because I remember, I think my brother had the video because we were both big Moonlighting fans. And then my brother's a big fan of Bruce Willis. And Yeah, it all came back to me watching it again.
Well, it's funny because we did a couple of videos after that with him. And he was friends with Robert. And he's also friends with Joey Puleva, who plays the priest in that video. He played keyboards in the Bad Boys on the American Bandstand thing and everything. He's an actor that was a friend of Bruce's, that worked for us as a production manager as well. So we threw him into it, and he got a little bit part in Die Hard, I think, as well, because of Bruce. So
when was the last time you spoke to Bruce?
Oh boy. I think I spoke to him probably maybe 10 years ago or something. He was looking for a copy of Return of Bruno. He wanted to get a copy because he was up for some kind of cinema award or something. And they wanted to use a bit of it in his intro or something. So he called actually, yeah, probably 10 years ago, something like that. I haven't talked to him in a while, although I still ask how he's doing and tell people to say hi, because I still hang sometimes with the people that are friends of his, you know, that hang with him.
I'm Dick Clark, and you've been watching Rock Heroes. Thank you and good night.
1988.
Excellent. Okay, so let's move to 1988. I don't know if you fancy doing an audio commentary for maybe Two Hearts.
That was the one with the multiple fills.
Yes, the multiple fills.
Whatever you want to do is fine.
3, 2, 1, play.
Okay. So the first thought was like, did you try and get back in contact with the lookalike that you didn't use for Easy Lover? Because that would have saved you on some of the effects, wouldn't it?
No, I know. No, but we wanted to do it. It was kind of like a Two Hearts is like an extension of Can't Hurry Love, you know, which he did the three fills in that. So we wanted to do something that was a little bit more intricate than Can't Hurry Love, which is just him in the spotlights. The bit right here that you're watching him as the film editor, that was done obviously last because we needed to put the stuff on the screen over his head.
Did you know Tony Blackburn was the guy that did the DJ guy introducing?
Yeah, because Paul Flannery was English from Liverpool, so he knew like who to get, you know, for all these things, and so he would suggest Tony to do it. And this was, I think this is kind of near Earl's Court, the studio that we did this in. It was a TV studio. And the way it's done, obviously, is we did have lookalike, a couple stand-ins that would stand in when you see hands and things behind that were on it, that were at the same time that we wouldn't see his face. Obviously, you had to have the movie in it because we're promoting the Buster movie at this point. And that's the whole reason why there's a film editor and he's editing the movie Buster and he's watching Phil Collins on TV. And so basically there's five Phil Collins in this video. The trick to this was we had five cameras and three of them were locked at all times. They didn't move. They just had to be locked. And we would make sure that his hands wouldn't go behind, you know, like himself. If he moved around on stage, the guy that the singing Phil or the bass player Phil, they wouldn't wander too much. The moving cameras, help the illusion, because you got some cameras moving and some are locked off. And when we'd have a moving camera like that camera there on the keyboard fill, you could see the shadow of somebody, which actually wasn't Phil's shadow, but was the look, another stand in doing mimicking film. So I wouldn't have to put the shadow in post. All the shadows were there already. So we would just, you'd actually just shoot one shot with Phil, and there's nobody on stage except for Phil. And it's pretty difficult. He'd have to know like where to look to get him to see the other Phil. And we set up certain points in the song like that, where we knew he was going to turn and do this. And this was very difficult to do, because he does, if you notice, nothing really crosses much. And when it does, we had to like kind of paint out those frames so that you wouldn't, you know, you could actually put the Phil behind when his hand got in front of the other Phil.
So when the singing Phil is, arm is in front of the bass playing Phil, how is that?
Well, we were going to do a green screen, but the green would kind of bleed all over. So we didn't do a green screen. So we just shot it. And then in post-production, we matted out all Phil's hand bits and things. It took quite a while to do it, but fortunately there's only, you know, there's not as many frames as you think. You know, it's 30 frames per second, but there's not as many frames as you think where it was a problem. And when it was a problem, when it didn't last long, it was pretty, I mean, when it wasn't a lot of movement, like if he was in front of them, but they weren't moving, it was pretty easy to just kind of redraw the line every once in a while to get it to work. So those are the most challenging parts, because we could have done it with a green screen, but it just seemed like with a white background, there was too much green bounce.
And which did you film first out of the band? Was it the singer first? Or?
Boy, I think we probably did the drums first, just so because of the shadows, I think, because you could shoot the drums up there and you could shoot him. And then I think we went forward after that and moved stuff, but all like the keyboards were there the whole time. And we didn't really put another person in unless it was a shot involved hands or side shot. The front shots, we never really did a take where somebody else was in there while he was playing.
Right. And back with your kind of love as well, when you're doing a video to promote a film, are you given the specific clips to use by the film company, or do you see the film and choose the clips you use? Is it all
we choose given? It. We choose it, and then you send it. Usually you send it to the, and we've done a number over the years, we've done a number of these things, and you send it to the film company. They usually like to see in advance kind of what you're thinking, which ones you're thinking of using. You don't want to use anything that's been used in previous videos. If, you know, like a number of times I've done videos for films where there's already been two or three videos from that film. So you want to, like I did one with a band called Go West, and
from Pretty Woman.
Pretty Woman. Yeah. And they had done already two or three videos, and so they didn't know what to do. So if you watch that video, there's very little of the movie in it, and it's all on these film strips, fake film strips. And that's basically because there was already two videos or three videos before us from that movie. But like with Phil, it was pretty, I think it was like the first video, or maybe Groovy was the first video from it. And you'd obviously take different scenes from Groovy Kind of Love than you would for Two Hearts.
Yeah. Because
Two Hearts, you want upbeat, you want things moving, a lot of action, a lot of quickness. Whereas in Groovy Kind of Love, you just want like this romantic scenes and things. That was an interesting one to do, because again, it was very short. Again, all these things were really more difficult back then, because you're dealing with film and film. In the case of Groovy Kind of Love, we took the scenes in a movie that we wanted, and we didn't have the film of the movie. We had a video that was a transfer from the original film. Once I edited the whole song, film, you know, scenes to the whole song, we sent that tape out and had a film made from that. And that's,
you had the film transferred to video, transferred back to film.
Yeah. So what's projected on the screen is actually my edit that I did on tape of the film. So the quality, you're always worried about the quality, but so that's how that's done. And obviously, you had to have a projectionist because none of us knew how to run that big projector. And Phil wanted to smoke a cigarette, which we did a whole version, I think. And I don't know if he's smoking a cigarette in the English version. Usually English versions in the later years, we always had to cut the cigarettes out of everything.
But I seem to recall at the time he was smoking the cigarette. And obviously the ones you see on YouTube now, he's smoking a cigarette. I was going to ask that question. Was there any pushback from the record company saying, "Or you can't have a video of him smoking all the way through"?
No, there wasn't really. There was never pushback because they owned the videos. So Tony would just give him the video and say, "Here's the video.
Take it or leave it. Yeah,
take it or leave it. But he wanted to smoke cigarettes just to give it that kind of look, and it works great. You know, luckily, like I said, years later, we'd always have to do two versions, like the La Belle Age one or Pat Benatar. There was a version with her cigarette and without a cigarette because of England, you know,
she has a cigarette the whole time at the microphone, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a version without the cigarette. There's a version but with YouTube, it doesn't matter now because the cigarette one's probably on everything.
Yeah. So in 1988, the year we're talking about, you made 27 music videos. There's a Christmas in Aspen special with John Denver.
Yeah.
15-minute HBO documentary about Ronald Reagan's son. And then there was the Genesis Live at Wembley Stadium video came out.
Yeah.
So that was all in one year. That sounds like an insane amount of work.
Yeah, but it didn't seem like it at the time.
Did you feel stressed, or was it just like, I'm just rolling with it? And it just, I mean, did it feel like it was a lot of work at the time?
I always look, it wasn't like a job. It was like fun. It wasn't like a job, you know? So, you know, you're doing stuff with all these people that are people you listen to over the years or watched over the years, and I never really felt like I was working. You know, the hard part was the long plane rides. You know, if you go to like back and forth to England, like I think I went 21 times or whatever it was. It was easily 21 times to England in 85, you know? And so those were always the worst part.
Yeah.
And being like jet lagged and getting into customs and not even able to see straight and basically, you know, walking in to, you know, like to a meeting that first day you're there and you're not even slept yet, kind of, you know, and you usually the first day would go well, you'd be tired and you sleep really well that first night. But by the second or third night, it was brutal to try to get up and to do things. In the middle of the day, you'd feel like somebody's like hitting you in the head.
Yeah. You worked with quite a few female artists, and this year you worked with both Gloria Estefan and Debbie Gibson. Was there pressure from the record company to make them look sexy? Could you just do a performance video with a female artist, or was there always that pressure to have them look a certain way?
Well, like Gloria video, the first one was 1, 2, 3. Mm. And that the idea that the record company wanted to do for that was make her look like she's an arena artist, as opposed to back then when she did that song, she had a Latin following, but not much crossover. And they were basically like a club band, like a large club band. And the whole thing was to make it look like she was playing arenas. So the people thought she's bigger than she was. So we set up this huge stage with all the lighting and everything. And they wanted to put her in chaps because they thought it's kind of a sexier look for her to be able to move around like that. And that was all their idea and doing, which I'm kind of glad, because in the other videos she had these like little skirts on and things like a tennis player would wear or something, you know. That changed her whole image, that video, not only sexy wise but also making her appear like she's a huge star. And they were wonderful people. Her and Emilio, her husband who managed her, were incredible people, and we did a lot of things with them. We did a homecoming concert with them and did a lot of videos with them, and so that was funny. And then Debbie, and I'm still friends with them today, you know. I mean, when I was working on this TV show called Chelsea Lately, she was on it as a guest. I went and, you know, backstage, and we're still very good, you know, like we don't hang out or go to dinner at each other's house. We're still very good friends to this day. They're such nice people, Emilio and her. So the same thing with Debbie Gibson. Debbie Gibson and I are still very good friends today. We will text each other. And I found her, she was very interesting to work with, because she would send stick figure drawings of things that she wanted you know, in this video. She wanted to do this, and she would send me like these little stick figure storyboards that I still have of some of the things that she wanted to do in a video. She'd send me, she'd rip out looks in magazines, like, you know, like a certain photograph or a look that she said, she said, I like this look, I like this look, I like this look. And her mother managed her. They were, again, great to work with. She, there was never, ever a idea to make her look sexy, because she was only, I think, like 16 or 17 when I first started working with her.
So yeah, I realized I asked the question. I was thinking, how old actually was Libby Gibson? Does this question apply to her?
Yeah, no. They just wanted her to be like this young girl, you know, and she was, you know, she was great to work with, because did a lot of videos, and she always kind of knew what she wanted. And it was, you know, it was kind of interesting for us to be able to do Iron Maiden videos and Debbie Gibson videos, you know, because you're kind of like the
full spectrum. There's a duet I'd love to see. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah.
Got to make
yes,
that.
Yes, definitely.
Can I play with my bass?
Okay, so into 89, and you do a Michael Jackson video, like,
right,
as you do
Librarian Girl.
Should we do the audio commentary, because I think the commentary will cover all the people in the video, and then after that we can talk a little bit about how it happened.
I can't remember all the names of the people, but we could do that. Could add them later.
Make a pop quiz, see how many you can name in 4 minutes.
Okay, the official video.
Yes, 350, 349 is the one that I've got.
3, 2, 1, play.
Okay, so this, I can't remember what her name is, but she's a model. The girl, the first girl you see is a model. The idea was to do a video with Michael that was different than all the stuff he's ever done before. And it wasn't like he didn't want to be in the video, but we thought, okay, it might be kind of cool to do a video without him until the end, because we didn't know what his schedule was like. And we were warned that he might not be able to devote that much time for the video. So the idea was to just do a video where he's actually behind the camera shooting all these people that he invited. That's Malcolm Jamal Warner right there. And I can't remember his name is, but he was in, I can't remember. And Paul Abdul there. And so we just gathered all these people together. That's Jackson. I can't remember what his name is. And then Whoopi Goldberg.
Jackie Collins.
And Quincy Jones.
Yeah.
Quincy Jones, a producer.
How did you get all these people?
Amy Irving there. I'm doing pretty well so far here.
Yeah.
And then there's Roseanne Arquette and John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John.
I mean, how did you get these people together? What was the...
This is the first time that they actually acted together since Grease, which was kind of neat. And what was, again, the same thing as the Bruno thing, whereas we would call people, you know, we called the people we knew. I had just done a TV special with Richard Dreyfuss, who's in this as well, the actor. I don't know if you know Richard Dreyfuss.
Yeah.
And Richard is friends with Steven Spielberg. And so I had called Richard and said, I'm doing this video at Michael Jackson. Would you like to be in it? And he said, I'll be in it as long as my daughter could be in it. And I said, sure, she could be in it as well. And so we said it's going to be 2 days because this was 2 days. We couldn't get everybody here the same day. So it's over a 2 day period on this set. We did this stuff. And Richard called back and said, I just talked to Steven Spielberg. He wants to be in it. Can he be in it? And I said, sure, Steven Spielberg. So Steven came and he brought Amy Irving, who was his wife at the time, I think. Yeah. And then we started calling people and we had a great Irene Cranita, who's a great production assistant or production manager, who started calling talent, just cold calling managers and agents and PR people. They say, we got Steven Spielberg, Richard Dreyfuss, and, you know, and we need, and all of a sudden everybody jumped in. First of all, people want to jump in because they probably want to be in a movie with Steven Spielberg, but also it was Michael Jackson, you know? So it's like, are you kidding me? Everybody wants to be in a Michael Jackson video. So there's Richard Dreyfuss right there. And so everybody jumped in, we got the calls. And again, it was a fun day, you know, to shoot, because you're shooting all these people and all these little bits that are unrelated. And Michael wasn't even there. Michael's was the third day. Okay. So all this happened and Michael wasn't even on the set at all. We came back and shot Michael's bit on a separate day from this.
Did everybody know that he wasn't going to be there? Cause they're making a Michael Jackson video. Did they know he wasn't going to be in the video?
Yes. Yeah, they did. Yes.
Yeah.
We had a shoot, make it look like he was there, but he's not really there. We knew he was going to come down in a crane. So everybody's pointing and saying, oh, there's Michael, like that. Okay. And then he just says, that's a wrap and that's it. And it was funny because the day that we shot him, it was on the same stage that we shot the other stuff, but obviously everything was set, was going on, everything. We just needed a crane, but when he arrived, it was almost like the president arriving. We got a call like 30 minutes beforehand saying he'll be there in 32 minutes. And then you get a call, he'll be there in 16 minutes. You know, it wasn't like, oh, Michael's like 10 minutes away or a half hour. It was, everything was like this precise, you know. And then before, when they said he'll be there in like 30 minutes, all of a sudden these other cars pulled up and they brought in a microwave oven. They brought in bananas. They brought in Bubbles the ape, or the little monkey or whatever it was. You know, everything came in before he got there, and they set up his dressing room. They had his security people walk through, his giant security people walk through. And a funny thing was, Paul Flattery and I were in the main production office and we were making notes, you know, about, okay, we're going to shoot Michael doing this, that we should be done with it. And we're talking, and these two big guys that are Michael's security people walk in the room, and they looked at us and they go, who are you two? We thought we were going to get the crap beat out of us. And Paul goes, I'm Paul Flattery. And the guy goes, what do you do? And he goes, I'm the producer. And then they point at me and go, who are you? And I said, I'm Jim Jukic. What do you do? And I'm the director. And the big guy turns to the other big guy and he goes, I guess these two guys can stay. And
it's very big of them.
And it wasn't like a comedy routine. They were like dead serious. You know, it was like, okay, these two could stay. And he walked away, you know? And so it was quite an experience. And then it was interesting dealing with him afterwards, because do you know who David Spade is? I don't know if you know who David Spade, the comedian. Yeah. He was in like a lot of movies with Chris Farley and things.
Yeah.
Well, David Spade was in this video as well. That was before he just got on Saturday Night Live, a show here, and he wasn't very famous at the time. And so he does a bit part in here where he does a head turn. He said something to somebody. So Michael called me, and it's weird when Michael calls, because you don't know if it's somebody pranking you or if it's really Michael, because it's like, hi, Jim, this is Michael Jackson. And you're like, okay, is it really Michael? And you'd kind of like sit and wait and see if they'd say something that was relevant that Michael would know before you made a comment, because otherwise it could be one of your friends just messing with you because they knew you're talking to Michael on the phone. And so Michael calls and goes, who is that guy with the blonde hair in the scene right before, you know, he named it? And I said, oh, that's David Spade. He's this upcoming comedian. He's going to be on Saturday Night Live. He's going to be a big star. Everybody's going to know who he's in, the movie star. And Michael goes, I don't like him. Take him out. So he was like take it, cut out of it. And it's funny because I've worked with David a number of times. In fact, I had just, like 3 months ago, I just did a show for Netflix with David. And that's always the funny thing is that he was cut out of a video that I did. And I always say, I say to David, I don't like you. Take you out, you know, and so he's ironically he was the one that didn't make it, and he ended up being a big star. But
that must have really hurt at the time to be in a Michael Jackson video and then get the one celebrity cut out.
Well, I don't think he knew he was the only one, but he was the only one.
He was the only one.
Right. Yeah, so he wasn't famous enough to be in a video, so he was cut out. So yeah, so that was the Michael Jackson video, and it was great. I mean, Michael was always a pleasure, you know, pleasant to work with. It's mostly, I found, you know, if there was any like weirdness about, you know, like being like a thing tough to deal with or anything, it wasn't him. It was always like his entourage, which was usually true in most cases. Yeah. The entourage always had to make like, you know, like themselves important, you know.
So how did you get that gig in the first place? How did you get to do a Michael Jackson?
Through Larry Stessel, who worked for Epic Records, who consequently was like one of the only people that Michael thanked when he won his Grammy Awards that year. But Larry was like Michael's key man at the record company for years. And Michael really liked Larry, and Larry was a friend of Michael's. And Larry was a really good friend of ours. And Mike, you know, Larry hired us for a lot of like the Cheap Trick videos and all the Epic, you know, bands, Epic Records bands that we did over the years. So Larry called us and said, we're doing this Michael Jackson video. I think you guys would be great for it. And then we thought, oh, this is great, but Michael might not be in it. And it's like, oh, thanks.
You know? Give him one hand, take with the other. Yeah.
Yeah. Although Paul Flattery had worked with Michael before, he did Beat It. I mean, not Beat It. He did Billie Jean with Michael.
Oh, right.
Paul produced that.
That's a pretty cool claim to fame. And how did it feel directing Steven Spielberg?
It was very scary. And if you notice, we did one of his shots.
Yeah, he did the jaw shot.
We did the jaws kind of thing. But he was more nervous than I was, which was really interesting because he's not really ever in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And so he even said to me, he goes, don't be nervous. I think I'm more nervous than you are. You know, he was very, really cool. Really nice.
Excellent.
He did it because he wanted Michael to be in Peter Pan, I think.
Okay. Yes. Cause Hook came out a couple of years later, didn't it?
Yeah. Hook. Yeah. So Steven did it to try to get Michael's attention.
Didn't quite work.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I've got for 89 or Scott Phil Collins, I Wish It Would Rain Down, which is one of my favorite Phil Collins songs. You okay going doing the commentary for that one? Because I think that'll be the last commentary.
Yeah, we could do that. Let me get out of here.
That is a really good video.
3, 2, 1, play.
Okay, so again, this is one of the ones that we always kind of like doing, putting real audio in the videos.
Yeah.
Because it not only because it made them different, because we thought, well, maybe someday we'll get a film and people think, oh, they could do actual dialogue and things. So that's a lot of the reason why we did it.
Videos are basically your showreel as well.
Well, like a showreel. And this is Jeffrey Tambor, the actor who went on to much greater things than this. He was in Arrested Development, I think, as well, a TV show.
Yes.
And the guy next to him is a guy named Jay, who was always a friend of ours who did he was an actor wannabe, but he was just a friend of Paul's and Paul's wife. And so we always, and he worked in our office quite often. So we thought, oh, okay, we'll give him a shot to do the acting bit. And he's always good for us and these things. And then this is downtown in a theater in downtown Los Angeles. And the band consists of, that's Eric Clapton there on guitar. And then you've got Chester on drums, Leland Sklar on bass, and the guy on the piano you'll see in a bit is Lamont Dozier, who was in the writing team of Dozier, Holland and Dozier, who wrote Can't Hurry Love and wrote all the Supremes and a lot of Four Tops Temptations songs over the years for Motown. And we thought this idea was possibly a film idea that we were thinking at some point. We thought we could do a film with Phil not being Phil,
with Phil being Bill Collins and the brother of Phil. And I don't, and it's just kind of like an idea that we never really developed. And then it became the video because it was a better video idea than a film idea.
Was that Phil, discussed with Phil as a potential film project? Films made, wasn't he?
Yeah, it was one of the things that we discussed with Phil as a possible film project before this was, you know, before he was like doing heavily into doing the acting thing. We thought this is kind of interesting to do, put him in this, and this would be a good demo for him as well as with the dialogue. But he always wanted to be an actor because he, you know, he grew up with in that whole, the family of actors and in acting school. And so he always enjoyed doing these bits where, and he's got, again, funny clothes on because he likes the old funny clothes that we'd always get. Eric's playing a Gibson, old Gibson guitar, which is interesting because he's a Fender guy in later years during this period, only played Fender guitars, but he played Gibson guitars. And subsequently, because he played the Gibson guitar, Gibson did a deal with me. And there's Lamont Dozier, the guy, the writer. Gibson did a deal with me because they figured, oh, if you can get a Gibson in Eric's hands, let's send Jim like 10 Gibson guitars and his next videos, he could probably get them into the videos. So I got like a bunch of free guitars from Gibson off of Eric playing Gibson here. And the Eric's playing in the orchestra pit later for the rest of this video. This idea probably we had for a number of years. It's like we always had ideas that were like banked, you know, and that we'd put in files. And with Phil, it got to the point where he would send songs and we would pull out ideas and say, okay, well, see, this one actually says Bill Collins. We'd actually pull out these ideas that we had and try to fit them with the song, to the point that by the time we got the But Seriously album, we would, you know, before he'd send the songs, we would send the ideas. And then he would say, okay, I got this song for this idea, this song for this idea, this song. He would pick which idea he wanted for the songs.
Right.
So, which was kind of like working backwards, which is kind of like, you know, instead of doing a soundtrack, doing doing the soundtrack first for the film, basically. So it was always fun working with him because he loved our ideas, and we just like sent him the whole list of things, and he would just say, okay, I like this, let's do this, let's do this, let's do that. This period piece thing we did, we wanted, you know, the Academy Awards were involved in this because we had to do it, and that was like this legal nightmare that we had to solve because we didn't realize that Amperis, the owners of the Academy Awards, you had to clear things and pay things to have anything resembling an Academy Award likeness. And so that it took quite a bit of legal work for that. It took a lot of legal work from the likenesses, like the likenesses of Marilyn Monroe, the likenesses of the guy that was in the Gone with the Wind guy, Groucho Marx. Groucho Marx was the easiest because Groucho Marx, his wardrobe person was Jill Collins's dad. So she had a connection to Groucho in the family. And all these things, I actually have all those things still, all these records and things that you see and these fake headlines and stuff in my storage bin. I have all these fake pictures that we mocked up and stuff. And so it like the Marilyn Monroe, all these fake pictures are all sitting in storage. Even the Maltese Falcon thing, again,
we get to direct Maltese Falcon as well.
Maltese Falcon with Phil Collins in it. And let's see here.
Do you still have that clapperboard? It says Maltese Falcon J.
No, you know what? I think Paul might have it. We kept most things, although I have a whole storage thing, like Academy Awards, that cost a fortune to do. Right. And to get the footage and to get all this stuff. Just because we didn't realize it at the time. Like this thing, having a statue behind and handing them the statue was unbelievably difficult. And then coming back to him on stage and then not making the cut was, you know, the typical thing that Phil never wanted to be seen as, you know, like, okay, he's the guy that makes it big. It was more like his whole true image, which is Phil was always, you know, like every man. And so this is kind of like, you know, showing again that he's just like everyone else. He's not Phil Collins. He's the guy that goes down to the pub and has a drink.
This is what I love about this video, because I don't think an American artist would ever end this way. It's a very kind of British sensibility of playing down your success. The idea he doesn't get the gig at the end. He's playing his big hit song, and the guy says, Jeffrey Tambor says, cut the number. Like, don't like it. Don't like his singing. Don't like the song. You know.
Yeah. So he basically cuts it. And we kind of learned. I learned this sensibility from Phil and from Paul, you know, basically, and which is very much what you said, what they do over there, what they wouldn't do over here.
Because like in America, the perception is you celebrate success, and in Britain, yes, kind of like you play it. You don't.
Yeah. Yes.
So how long did that take to shoot?
Well, the stuff in the stage was one day, with the band and the performance was like one day, and then we also shot in that stage. We shot I think we shot out front, coming into the lobby and the Academy Award platform and all that bit was there. It's probably that, and then a second day for the Maltese Falcon and some of the other little bits. So, you know, like him turning with he was a big, as you know, he's a big Alamo fan and Davy Crockett. That's why he wanted to have that bit in there with the Davy Crockett hat and stuff. So that was, I'd say the whole thing was maybe 2 days, and there might be a spillover of a third day. Cause a lot of times we would shoot another video and it'd be a bit we'd need, like throwing the records on the ground with the articles and everything. We'd shoot that like on like a Beach Boy video or a Doobie Brothers video or some other day that we had a camera.
All right. That's a great video. Another great video.
The My Atisography Quick Fire Round.
Okay. Your favorite single shot from one of your 80s videos?
Single shot?
Yeah, one shot. What's your favorite shot? Because I'll tell you, mine actually is the shot you have of Tony Banks in on the keyboard in Tonight, Tonight, Tonight. It's a brilliant shot. Where he's kind of in the shadows.
Uh-huh.
Do you have like an image from one of your videos that you love?
But I think it would be No Son of Mine is the 90s, right?
Yeah.
Well, my favorite shot probably from the 80s videos would be the low wide lens shot of David Bowie in Modern Love when he first comes on the stage.
Oh, because that's slow motion.
Yeah, when he's, and it's like the slow motion, he runs forward and he comes right up to the camera and it's a wide lens right at the floor of the stage.
Get things done.
Video you made which you thought should have been a bigger hit, so when you made it you thought this is going to be a smash and it didn't quite work out that way?
I thought Liberian Girl by Michael Jackson should have been a bigger hit, but then I found out that they only released it for some reason as a single in Europe before it was really never really released here as a single. I don't think
even in the UK it was like the 14th single from the album. It's like
I wish it would have been. I thought it would have been a bigger hit because of the video.
Yeah,
and it wasn't. So I guess that's the answer.
The biggest, you may have mentioned this in a previous chat, but the biggest diva moment you experienced on set.
Diva? Oh, with Sheena Easton.
Yeah, so that was the biggest. I thought.
Yes, when I did the video with Sheena Easton and Kenny Rogers, when he was deathly ill, and hardly able to stay on the set, and yet she complained the whole time. And I thought, this is so ironic that she would be the one complaining.
Yeah. Worst song you did a video for?
Ooh, that's tough, because people, I hate if anybody's listening. Probably there's a video, and I can't remember what the name of it is. You'd have to look it up, I guess. A David Hasselhoff video.
You did a David Hasselhoff.
Yes, David Hasselhoff video.
That's shooting fish in a barrel, isn't it? What about like an established act you didn't like the song by?
I'd have to say it was a David Hasselhoff video. But if it wasn't that, for an established band, it's like a blank, because I don't, kind of a blur. Nothing would nothing really by Genesis or Phil Collins. If the least favorite Genesis video was from in the 90s, so I wouldn't that wouldn't be eligible for this show.
Which one was
it? It was on the We Can't Dance album. It was it was just a performance video that we shot, and I can't even remember the name of it.
Is it Hold On My Heart?
No, it was a proper video.
Tell Me Why.
Tell Me Why, I think, yeah.
Okay.
Tell Me Why, which I don't know if it was ever a hit or not, but it wasn't. So, the ones that I didn't like, I can't remember the song. Like there was a video for the Eric Martin Band that I did. These obscure kind of things that I don't even remember the names because I blocked them out because they were so bad.
All right. So I think the David Hasselhoff one you were so embarrassed by, you had it expunged from your records. I can't find it on IMDb. I think you've had it removed. In Stalinist kind of removal. It doesn't exist in your...
It was everybody. It was everybody something. Everybody sing or everybody... Everybody Sunshine. It was called Everybody Sunshine. You could watch it later on YouTube. Everybody Sunshine. Everybody.
Okay, a couple more questions then. Did I ask this? Your favorite Genesis and Phil Collins song?
Genesis, I would probably say with Genesis, it does it have to be an 80s song?
No.
if it was an 80s song, it would probably be Cinema Show, you know, or Los Endos, Cinema Show, Los Endos. Brilliant songs to me. They were Peter Gabriel's era, so I don't think they were 80s. But Genesis in the 80s, it was in the 80s because it was Fading Lights from We Can't Dance.
That's a beautiful song. Yeah, I always feel like they should be ending their live shows now with it because it's such a beautiful, like, goodbye. It's fading out into the
kind of song. Tony Banks wrote the lyrics to that, pretty sure. Yeah. But, Turn It On Again was always one of my favorites.
Yeah, another great song.
Tonight, maybe. Because it was just so cool of a song. And for Phil, it would be You Know What I Mean.
Yes, yes, beautiful song.
From Face Value. Just leave me alone with my dreams. You've taken everything
else. You know what I mean. Great choices. Four more questions, then we're done. Your worst professional experience of the 80s?
Worst professional experience of the 80s? Probably after I did, it wasn't horrendous, but like after I did my second video, which is Kenny Rogers and Sheena Easton, Kenny's manager, Ken Cragen, he had me come over to his office and he didn't scold me, but he basically said in the edit that he wanted more close-ups of Kenny because Kenny's images, his face and his beard. And he kept saying, right here, more Kenny, more Kenny, more Kenny. And he was right. And so it was kind of like an embarrassment more than a bad experience. And then also, you know, a couple like GTR, if that was the 80s, was GTR 80s?
Yes, 86.
Having to sit singularly in between Hackett and Howe in the edit session, each one of them wanting more shots of themselves.
Oh, and how do you deal with that?
Well, it's tough, and they count them, you know. Counted shots in a video before they got there. Hackett knew how many shots of him and Howe were in there, so it was weird.
That's what I love about Genesis. I can't imagine them ever doing that, the three of them. Do you know what I mean?
I know, no, never at all.
Yeah, okay. And your best professional experience of the 80s?
Probably doing Modern Love, because when I did that, it made me a legitimate director, and having worked with David and just, you know, setting me on a whole new level. I think that would probably be the best overall experience.
Because it set up the rest of your career, basically. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Eternal Jukebox.
I do a thing called the Eternal Jukebox with guests where they get to pick which three songs, like with producers, they produced. So assume there's a video jukebox as well. You can only keep three of your videos for all eternity. Which three would you keep from the 80s?
I keep no, is No Son of Mine in the 80s?
90s, can't have it, I'm afraid.
Sorry. I would say Take Me Home, Billy Don't Lose That Number, and let's see, those are both Phil's, aren't they? Maybe La Belle Age, since that was always one of my favorites.
Artie, nobody makes any money when you're in jail, okay? You gotta tone the act down tonight.
Look, I don't want any more of his stunts in my club. I don't need the headaches.
All right, it's all right, bud. I spoke to him, said there's no problem.
No problem? The police are crawling all over my club.
Isn't that a shame?
Excellent. And finally, your three words to describe your ages.
Whirlwind. I don't know how you say great time in one word, but brilliant time and great music. See, you can't say it in three words, can you? Oh, boy. But whirlwind, obviously, because everything was going so fast. And creativity, you know, I'd say creative because everybody was trying to do the next thing, be the next, you know, everything you did video-wise and stuff that I did. And then it was like the experience that would probably be the word, you know, because it was a great experience. I mean, going to London as much as I did and working with all these great people was like such a great experience.
This is the end of the interview. Thank you very much.
So thanks to Jim for the interview. Really loved chatting to him. Also, thanks to him for the pictures. As referenced in the interview, there's the Genesis Bricks storyboards, pictures of him with the band, and also the Take Me Home lyric he annotated over the 7 month period when he had it in his bag. You'll see all those on the Atisography Twitter account. We're talking about the I Wish It Would Rain Down video, that Lionel Richie was there. I wish he'd been in the video. What a missed opportunity that was. You could have had Jeffrey Tambor saying, we need a singer, and then he appears from backstage holding a mop and then says,
"Hello, is it me you're looking for?"
And then Jeffrey goes, "No, Lionel, not now." And he, "That would have been so good, that would have worked so well." Ooh. And then that's why I wasn't the music video director in the 80s. That and the fire would have been about 13. A couple of things, I don't know why I said this in the interview.
So there's a video for the Respect Yourself single, and then there's a Return of Bruno mockumentary.
Why did I say Return of Bruno, not Return of Bruno?
And then there's a Return of Bruno.
Why did I say that? I didn't even notice it at the time. Why did I say that? It's like, now, I would say half the listeners to this podcast are from America. And I love America, love American people, hi at all. But it's something that you Americans do as well. I always think whenever you say Monty Python, you always say Monty Python. You always emphasize the second syllable, Monty Python. And you shouldn't, it should be Monty Python. You focus on the first syllable, you throw the second syllable away. Monty Python. I'm Monty Python.
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
It's like, yeah, I had a lovely Twitter chat with my dear friend John at the Hustle podcast. Hello, John. He knows where this is going if he's listening. We had a discussion on the age-old aluminium versus aluminium debate. British people do not understand the aluminum thing. Where did that come from? Now, if you're American and you insist you're correct on that, can I ask you one thing? Speaking of the elements, I'm going to give you two words here. I'm going to spell them out. And wherever you are, I want you to say them out loud how you would say these words, okay? But try this one first, okay? C-A-L-C-I-U-M. If you're walking down the street or whatever, just say the word out loud. And the second one, H-E-L-I-U-M. Now, if you would say calcium and helium, then I concede you're right. But if not, calcium, helium, aluminium. Yeah, just saying. And it's not a judgment, you know,
being English, we cannot judge America or anyone else for their for anything, really. We've got our own Trump. He's just posh and went to Eton. It's like a Trump that had elocution lessons. But he's just as corrupt, narcissistic and venal as the American version. So we cannot judge. We have our own problems. I've gone slightly off topic there. But love to all my valued listeners around the world. I appreciate you listening. Thank you. What's next? I've got a good one coming up next, and especially good to me because it won't take a lot of editing. So I'm really looking forward to this one. That should come out in a couple of weeks. Shall we leave it? Has to be something Genesis related, and I thought I heard this recently, and I thought this is great. It's a cover of Land of Confusion by the Norwegian female folk group Katzenjammer. Katzenjammer. And this is brilliant. I love this version. I think the best cover versions are by female vocalists. There's something about a female vocal that really brings out the melody of a song. And this is a very different version, and it just shows what a great song Land of Confusion is. You pageum, you're wrong. So until next time, keep the faith, whatever faith it is you possess. Bye.
I've lost a dream, a thousand dreams. Been haunted by a million screams. But I can hear their marching feet moving into the street. Now did you read the news today?
Told me you were leaving. I didn't ask for
Fantastic. Wasn't it fantastic?
Great.
It's really fantastic.